But we are nearing the end of our time in the Gospel of Matthew. We have been in this gospel basically all spring, looking at the life and teaching of King Jesus of Nazareth. What kind of king was he? What kind of king? What kind of kingdom did he bring? And we get to this morning to a seminal moment. We've got 3 weeks left in Matthew's gospel, today included. It's a seminal moment in his life and ministry. It's a very well-known moment. We have gotten to the final week, really the final days of his life. And tonight is the last night before his death. This is a famous scene known as the Last Supper. So will you turn with me in your Bibles to Matthew 26, or on your phones, in your Bible apps, or up on the screen. This is Matthew 26, starting in verse 17. And there is a lot to cover, a lot to unpack, and hopefully behold together. So let's dive in. Matthew 26, starting in verse 17. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, that's another name for Passover, same feast, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at table with the 12. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him one after another, "Is it I, Lord?" He answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." Judas, who would betray him, answered, "Is it I, Rabbi?" He said to him, "You have said so." Verse 26, now as they were eating, Jesus took bread and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay, so what was just read, like we said, is famously known as the Last Supper. There's probably a scene in your mind that is at least somewhat impacted by a famous piece by Leonardo da Vinci, The Last Supper. And that's a brilliant piece, you know, like part of the Renaissance, helped shape Western civilization, all those things. It's just that Leo's piece looked nothing like the scene we just read about. It is remarkably not what it looked like, mainly because that's not how they ate meals at tables and chairs like that didn't exist thousands of years before Leonardo da Vinci, but two, because Jesus wasn't white. So that's not that scene's wrong. But so it's important piece. Just forget about it though, as we walk through this scene, because this scene takes place as they're reclining at table. They're laying down with their feet out, kind of elbows and heads into the table for a Passover meal. Now, if you're a Jewish person, and like these disciples were, you've grown up with this meal as a part of your annual liturgy, your annual ritual, every year since you have a memory of consciousness. Like every Jew was raised on this meal year in and year out. So when Jesus sends disciples into the city, which we'll look at in just a second, to prepare for it, they knew exactly what they were doing. Every Jew was wildly familiar with how this meal went, what this meal's preparation looks like, and what they were doing when they went into the city. So look at this first part. This is just kind of introing us, setting up what scene we're in before we talk about the meal in a minute. First part of the story starts in verse 17. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, another name for the Passover feast, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, "The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples." And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them. They prepared the Passover. So Passover was this 7-day, week-long feast that took lots of preparation. It was a pilgrimage feast. It was the OG of feasts for all Jewish festivals. Pilgrims would travel from all over the known world, Roman Empire, where the Jews had been scattered in the diaspora after Babylonian captivity. They were everywhere, speaking all kinds of different languages, but they would all descend on Jerusalem for the Passover feast, as well as a few others. But this was the granddaddy. This was what everybody came out for. This was Coachella, okay? This was like what everybody wanted. I don't know. Is Coachella where everybody wants to go? I don't know. More than Bonnaroo, right? What are we talking about? Here we go. So Jews are coming. There's hundreds of thousands of people in the city of Jerusalem, which is not a very big city. So it's crammed. There's alleyways. There's smells. People are cooking. There's miniature family reunions happening everywhere. There's dancing. There's music. It's a party. Everything's happening all week, and all this is happening, and Jesus says to his disciples, they're like, hey, the week's moving on. Where are we going to eat Passover meal? How would you have us go prepare the meal that you're going to serve to us? He was going to be the host. And Jesus says, find a certain man, which is hilarious because like, okay, is he wearing a hoodie? Like, what do you want me to write down? How do you want us to find this certain man? And one theologian literally that I studied this week said that he calls this one of Jesus's spy movie moments. Like, go into the city, find a man. When you find that man, tell him the teacher says we need a room, and he'll know exactly what you're talking about, and he'll lead you up to this secret upper room. And that happens. It's like, Jesus can't go into the city himself because since the week begun, he's ridden in on a donkey. He's flipped over tables at the temple. He has claimed to be God. His eyes are on him, and Jesus knows I can't go in and just waltz around the city. I'm going to be arrested, and I know I'm going to be arrested. I can't be arrested yet. Because Jesus is meticulously planning every detail of this week and how he would give his life away. So they go into the city, they find a certain man, he leads them to this secret upper room, and the meal begins. And this meal called Passover was a meal that commemorated something. We all have meals that commemorate things, birthday dinners and graduation dinners and things, but this was a meal that did much more than just commemorate. It was something that as a part of the Jewish tradition, it was so a part of their DNA, it was so a part of their culture, it was so a part of their society, it was a meal that formed them. It was a meal that shaped them. It was a meal that did something to the participants year in and year out. So what was this Passover story and what was this meal that was a part of their formation as people? Okay, so brief or not so brief history of Passover. Passover, the night, was the night thousands of years before Jesus, where the Israelites were an enslaved people in Egypt underneath Pharaoh. They had been there for about 400 years. God calls Moses at the burning bush to go back to Egypt to set his people free. Moses goes back to Egypt. Pharaoh, let my people go. Pharaoh will not do it. He hardens his heart. He refuses. The enslavement gets worse. The conditions get harsher. And Moses keeps amping up the plagues. And this plague signs and wonder battle royale is God showing his power against the Egyptian gods of Pharaoh till finally it culminates with the 10th sign, the 10th plague. This night is known as Passover night because God was going to visit the land of Egypt that night. He's going to send the angel of death that represents God's wrath and God's just judgment against what's happened in Egypt to Israel. He's finally going to set his people free from the hand of Pharaoh, and he's going to do it this way. He's going to strike dead the firstborn child, the firstborn son in each family. Unless there is bloodshed of a spotless lamb over the doorpost and over the doorframe of the home. And so if the Lord, as he's descending into Egypt that night, sees the blood on the doorpost, if he sees the blood, he will pass over that house and not bring death and judgment to that house. So that happens in Egypt. It's a horrific night. There's wailing in Egypt. There's wailing in Pharaoh's house because his firstborn son is struck down. And so now Pharaoh finally relents and he sets God's people free. He gives them their freedom that they have asked for. And the Israelites, for the first time in their history, are a people. They have an identity. They are no longer an enslaved people. They are a free people and they're heading to the promised land. God said, the land that I promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I will give to you now. It's yours. Walk to it. But on their way out of town, this is still Passover night. They're still heading out of town. They get to the Red Sea, and there's a Red Sea in front of them, and they turn around, and Pharaoh has changed his mind, and Pharaoh's coming after them. So they got Pharaoh on one side and the sea on the other, and God parts the Red Sea. The Israelites walk through it, and he collapses the sea on Pharaoh as a final stamp of judgment on all of Pharaoh's armies, and God has officially rescued and saved and delivered his people, the Exodus. That's Passover. all took place on this last night. Moses sings a song. It gets into a musical because Exodus 15, everyone knows the words of the song that's never been sung before. They all sing together. That's the Passover night. All of that is what Passover represented and caused them to remember. And it's a night that didn't just include a divine intervention of rescue. It did. God set us free from Egypt. It also included a night of the Israelites finally learning who they were. You are my people, and I have heard your cries, and I am coming to get you out. I am coming to take you to the promised land. You will be my people now. And all these themes and realities that were at play in the original Passover story are also in the meal. And this meal that the Jewish people celebrated every year represented all that we just talked about. If you can imagine massive realities of divine intervention and declaration of identity, and this is who you are, and this is where I'm taking you, and I will bring judgment on your enemies, and I will protect you from wrath and judgment, and all this, slaves to free, death and judgment coming to visit, but I will protect you from death and judgment. That also marked this reality. This is in the meal too, where it represented this idea, this experience for God's people who had been crying out and crying out and crying out and crying out for freedom, that finally God heard them. He turned their bitterness into joy. Like, that's a part of the meal. Like, eat something so bitter, raw horseradish, so that you actually begin to cry and feel what it felt like to be a slave for 400 years. At least taste it. And then believe that God turns bitter things into joy. That's part of the meal. Remember that God remembers you. That's part of the meal. Passover night was also a night not just of rescue and saving and God heard your cries and he's coming to get you, but also a night of looking ahead into promises yet to be fulfilled. There's a land that's yours. There's a land that I promised you and I'm here to take you to that land. So all these themes, all of this reality that God is doing on this looking back and looking ahead, they were so to look ahead that night. That's why the bread had to be unleavened bread. We don't have time for the dough to rise. Use bread without yeast. So that you're ready to go because God is so gonna take you. You gotta be looking ahead. Have your sandal straps ready to flee with haste. So this night of saving, this night of redeeming, this night of purchasing, this night of protecting was also a night of promising, looking ahead into what's to come. All of those themes that we just talked about, slavery, freedom, judgment, protection, bitterness, joy, promises, expectation, all of that is in the meal. The meal for the Israelite people was a chance for them to tell and retell that story with all of those themes. And different elements of the meal capture those themes. But the whole meal was saying to the people that participated in it every year in 100 different ways, this is who we are now. This is who we were. This is what happened to us. And now this is who we will be. This is who we are, this is who we were, this is who we will be. All of the space-time continuum of, do you remember when God did this for our ancestors? And then in so retelling that story, guess what everybody at the table was also hearing? Not just who they were, but who God was. This is who God was. This is who God is. And this is who God will be. That story was told and retold every year. And when God is setting up this meal in Exodus chapter 12, when he's setting up this meal for his people, the night that he's gonna rescue them, he sets it up and he tells them, he institutes it. He says, hey, I want you to do this meal. When you get to the promised land, I want you to do this meal every year. Don't ever forget this. Don't ever forget this night. You're gonna have a meal just like you had in Egypt every year. But please note that the remembering, the practicing of Passover was not for the Lord. The Lord instituted a remembering for the people because he wanted them to remember. He hadn't forgotten, they had, and they would. So you need to remember by doing this, because doing this over and over and over again has power for you. It has importance to you. And I don't ever want you to forget. I don't ever want you to not tell your children about what I did for you that night. And so this meal, like we said, it is the OG. It is the oldest and longest standing tradition of the Jewish people in their history. Each year you are to remember what the Lord has done. Now, it's a very Jewish thing to use symbols and tangible elements like an experience to try to begin to understand like divine mysteries and divine realities. So the Lord instituted a meal, not just a teaching, not just a lecture. Sit your kids down every night and just tell them the story. Yes, tell them the story, but do it with these elements that you can taste and see and smell. I want you to experience it. So that even if your four-year-old who's hearing the story doesn't fully understand everything, they're gonna know this meal is telling me a story. It is becoming a part of the generation. It becomes the story that they would tell as they grew up. It is a meal that through its very practice and repetition formed a people. The Passover meal did that. The point of the meal was the repetition. Don't reinvent it. Don't recreate it. Don't try to make it better. Just do this meal every year so that you never forget. And there are some things in Christian traditions for us, where innovation is not a virtue. Like, we don't need to make it better or rethink it or redo it. The point is, do this every time because it is your story. It's the story of God and his people. This is the oldest living religious meal in human history. Jewish people have been doing this meal of Passover for 3,500 some odd years. 3,500, three millennia. People have been doing this meal continuously without a break. Okay? Jesus takes that meal, the forming meal of Passover, remembering and looking ahead, the like institutional meal of the people. He takes that meal, and this is what he does with it. He doesn't cancel it. He continues it. He's not making it better. Well, he is in a way. What he's saying though is this meal that you've been practicing for all these years, it was actually always pointing to me. I'm completing it, and now I'm reconstituting this Passover meal to show you that it was always pointing to me, it was always about me, and so I'm taking the practice of Passover, and I'm transforming it into its fullness, into its consummation of what it was always about. It was about me, and now let me reconstitute it, reinstitute it, and call it the Lord's Supper for the church. This is the creation of communion. This is where it comes from. This is the Eucharist, which is just a word that means a giving of thanks. It's a meal of thanks for what God has done. This is the meal. This is Passover turned communion. And Jesus isn't canceling the meal. He's saying this meal was always about me. And now that I'm here, this is how you practice it. So this is what Jesus is doing, creating a new ritual for the people of God. And just like Passover, they were commanded to do it every year so that they never forgot. Jesus in communion, he doesn't say it in our Matthew version, but in Mark and Luke, when he's instituting this meal of communion, transforming Passover into its completion of him, he says to the people, do this often and do it in remembrance of me. It's the only thing Jesus commands of his people as an act of obedience. It's the only thing he commands them to keep on doing. Always do this practice. Always do this. Always practice communion. Now, that's the like history of the theology of Passover into communion. Maybe you knew that. Maybe you had heard some of that or all of that already. What you maybe didn't realize is what I didn't realize this week in studying this, is that this meal that is the night before his death, Jesus is using this meal to do something and show something. And it's all around his death. That's my body broken for you, which we're talking about. That's my blood shed for you. It's all about his death. And only one other time in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, only one other time, this shocked me, only one other time does Jesus ever try to explain what his death was for. Now, he talks about his death a lot. He predicts his death. Disciples don't get it. He talks about his death a lot. Son of Man has to go suffer. But only once does Jesus explicitly give the reason for or the meaning of his death. That's Mark chapter 10, end of Mark. He says, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life, death, as a ransom for many. That's the only theology Jesus gives about the meaning of his death. Which is kind of shocking because maybe you've heard, if you're a Christian or not, maybe you've heard the death of Jesus is kind of important. And you would think for how important this event is, which by the way, the gospel writers want you to know how important the death of Jesus is. And here's how you know that the gospel writers wanted you to know how important it is because in the ancient world, airtime, like how much time a writer gives to something is showing you what they think is important. And every gospel writer, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all give more chapters to Jesus' suffering and death than they give to any other event in his life. John gives like half of his book to the last week of his life because he wants you to focus on, all the gospel writers are saying, his death, his death, his death, his death. His death was the most important thing that he did. His death is the thing that we want to write to you about more than anything. His death mattered. So if it's so important, why didn't he say more? Why didn't Jesus ever write a little booklet about his death? Why didn't he have a little scribe with him and say, hey, I'm going to teach now. I'll give you 3 points about the meaning of my death. I want you to copy this down so we can add it on. Why doesn't he do that? You could put on less than 1 page the amount of words Jesus says that unpack the meaning of his death. Why did he do that? Well, it doesn't mean that Jesus did not want to give meaning and understanding as to why he was going to die. It's central to his whole mission. But what it does mean is that instead of writing anything, saying anything, didactically teaching about something, instead of doing all that, if people are going to understand his death, guess what he wanted them to do? He wanted them to have a meal to understand it. A symbolic meal. A meal that was already very rich in history and symbolism and meaning and formation. Jesus didn't give a lecture on the meaning of his death. Now, there's plenty of wonderful places in the Bible that do. Paul seemed to have no problem explaining the meaning of Jesus' death. Jesus just didn't do it. Doesn't mean it's more holy. That Paul's words are scriptural too. It just means that in Jesus' teaching to his people, his disciples, he didn't give a teaching, he gave a meal. The most important event in the life of Jesus, and he never almost teaches on it explicitly. Isn't that fascinating? Almost as if to say this, my death is so important. My death is so meaningful. My death is accomplishing so much for you. It would be doing it a disservice if I tried to explain it all to you. It's almost too deep for words what my death will do for you. I want you to experience, he's saying to his disciples and to us, the reality of my death with all of this symbolism and imagery and history and formation from this meal, not just hear about it with your minds. I want you to taste it. I want you to feel it with this meal that's 1500 years old. And I'm going to show you how this meal was all about my death. So an example of this, of experiencing something like with your whole self versus just learning or hearing a lecture about it. A couple examples. Would you rather, asking for a friend, read about Steph Curry playing basketball, or would you rather go see him do it? Steph's a basketball player in the NBA, okay? He's like greatest shooter of all time. Let me find a different one. Would you rather see reels on Instagram or read articles about the Eras Tour? Right? Now I'm speaking to the people. Or would you rather go to Nissan in the rain for 3 hours? Who was there that night? Anybody? Yeah. I'm not sure if that means you're Christian or heathen, because I'm pretty sure it was a Sunday, but that's fine. But, right? You'd rather be there than hear about it. Would you rather read an online cookbook about how Dicey's makes their pizza, or would you rather go inhale it for yourself? Right? Have y'all had Dicey's? Oh my gosh, that hot honey pepperoni, my gosh. Yeah. It's incredible. You want to experience it. You don't want to read about it. You want to taste it. You don't want someone to tell you how great the Eras Tour show was. You want to be there. That's what Jesus is doing with this meal. He's doing this with the Last Supper. I'm going to let you experience, disciples, the reality, the beauty, the mystery, and the meaning of my death instead of just telling you about it. Because we all know this, there are things that we can experience before we fully understand them. And Jesus wants to get it into them, not just so that they can re-explain it to someone else. He wants them to experience it. He wants the reality and mystery and beauty of his death to go into their like primitive brain, like the deepest part in them, the place that they don't even control all the function of. I'm trying to get it into you because that's what this meal has done for you over the millennia that your people have been practicing it. It's in you now. I don't just want you to have cognitive knowledge acquisition about the theology of my death. That'll come. I want you, disciples, to experience the beauty of it, the pain of it, the mystery of it, the accomplishment of it. where maybe even when you leave the meal, disciples, you won't be able to fully explain all the theology of my death, but you will have known that you experienced something that changed you. This is what makes Jesus brilliant. A lot of things make Jesus brilliant, namely that he's God, but this is one of the like teaching things of Jesus that makes him brilliant. He timed all of this so that all of it would happen over Passover. He made this happen. He could have been arrested by the Romans and the Jewish authorities on a random Monday and no one would have known about it. And he could have been executed. He could have been killed in a hallway and his blood would have still been sacrificial for you. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that he's tying it all to this story that has been going on for millennia and saying, this is what my death is about. He's telling a different tale. He's culminating a different crescendo. He's painting a different masterpiece. Because Jesus knows that this story that's in them, that has formed them, that has shaped them as a people, was always pointing to something greater. And he wants to put the reality and the mystery and the beauty of his death in the context of this grand story of redemption. So we're going to walk through a couple elements of this meal that he's making about himself as he's showing you that Passover was always about him. But here's what has been challenging for me as a preacher this week. I have read a lot on this. I watched a Passover meal this week. Like I have deep dived on it. Kind of arrogantly to say, well, Jesus never really taught about the meaning of his death, but let me teach about it. Like what I'm trying to do is what they got to experience that night, which is I just want you to see what he showed them. I want to unpack and pull back the curtain on, let me show you what Jesus showed them. I'm not going to try to explain it all away. So Jesus is injecting deep truth into them on a couple different levels. Passover begins and there's a couple different courses. It takes about 2 hours. I wanted to do like a Passover meal up here and like, let's do it together. It's about 2 hours, which is about as long as I preach. So could have, you know, give or take, but we didn't do that. We could have served communion today, but we didn't do that. We did that the first Sunday of the month and there's kind of too many other moving parts. So we weren't able to do that. So I'm just going to try to paint a picture with my words on what they got to experience that night. But as the Passover meal begins, one of the first courses is this dipping of a lettuce leaf by all the participants. Okay, that's important to know that in one of the early stages, that's what they do. They dip it into this cup that he serves them and they eat it. It's the bitter herbs of horseradish. But this meal opens up, look at verse 21 and 23, because that's know that a dipping is a part of the early stages of the meal. Verse 21, and as they were eating, the meal has started. He said, truly I say to you, one of you will betray me. Buzzkill, Jesus. And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him one after another, is it I, Lord? He answered, he who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. Okay, so I've always heard that and thought, so he says that, and now they're all like taking their little lettuce leaf back, and like Judas is like, give me that. You know, like that's not what happens. That's not what happens. Newsflash, when Jesus says this, everyone has already dipped their hand in the dish. Jesus is subtly telling them all, you're all gonna betray me. Just give it a few hours. In other scenes, Peter gets all macho, not me, you know, and Jesus has to calm him down. And then Jesus makes Judas's betrayal the pinnacle. Judas is going to betray him in a different way. But he's telling them all, you're all going to betray me. The one who dipped in the dish with me. And they would have gone, that was all of us. So who are you talking about? That's the point. And then the course moves through a couple more cups of wine. There's 4 cups of wine total. There's a blessing that's said before each cup of wine with lots of tradition. It's the blessing that's before these cups is Psalm 113, which was our call to worship this morning. Like this is what they read before the blessing. There were other things that were read. 4 cups of wine total. And Jesus, the host, is moving through these courses. And as the host, he would rip the bread, the unleavened bread, crack it, and then pass it to the individuals for them to eat on. And as Jesus is ripping apart this bread and as he's passing it across the table and as the disciples are chewing on this bread that they have crunched in their mouth since they've been alive and since their ancestors have been doing this for 1500 years, as they're being reminded of the deliverance that this unleavened bread represents and they had to leave because they were being redeemed, all of this, Jesus says at the end of verse 26, look at this. They're chewing the bread. And he says, this is my body. I'm sorry, what, Jesus? So you've made it weird, okay? Like, what are we talking about? He's saying, hey, this meal that y'all have always eaten, this meal that tells you who you are and who God is and what he's done for you, it was actually all about me. This meal has always been pointing to me. It was only a foreshadow. It was only a foretaste. The story of redemption and rescue and promises and bitterness into joy, the story of all of that was always just an appetizer for the feast of me. And literally, think about this, like with bread, the disciples who prepared this meal had to bake this bread. So they like had to get the dough ready, and they have to roll it up and tear it apart and smash it and then put it in an oven, and it bakes and it crisps, and then it comes out and it feeds them. It gets scorched, and then they ingest it. Jesus saying, that's me. I'm actually the bread of life that like is gonna get scorched and pounded and crushed and rolled in, and then actually I'm gonna roll out and feed you with myself. But not just the bread. Then it's the wine too. Scholars aren't sure, is this the third cup of wine or the fourth cup of wine? It doesn't really matter. It's the latter half of the meal. And as he pours the next round of wine, which all the wines were poured out for blessing, and let us remind you of the blessing of redemption, and drink to this, the Lord of the fruit of the vine, who makes this rich wine for us to drink, and that we might enjoy it like we enjoy our redemption. Drink this wine and watch it being poured out. As the wine is being poured, verse 27, Jesus said, oh, by the way, I'm pouring this out, and as you're drinking it, this is my blood. This is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Okay, vampire Jesus, you just made it weirder. Like, what are this, like, we think like, oh, how sweetly Christian and traditional that this is the institution of the sacrament of communion. Yes, but can you imagine being these disciples? Like, what are you talking about, Jesus? In John 6, you talked all about how, like, unless we eat of your flesh and drink of your blood after the feeding of the 5,000, and no one knew what the heck you were talking about. We still don't. Like, all that you just told us is this wine that I'm on my third or fourth glass of that now tastes really good. And now I'm like wondering, what is all this blessing and redemption? And now you're saying this is you? This was all about you? Jesus is saying, just like this wine is poured out to represent the blessing of redemption, so will my blood be poured out. And when it pours out, disciples, it's going to cover a multitude of sins, including your own. Remember the betrayal I just told you that all of you would commit? My blood's going to pay for that too. So drink up. Drink it all. My blood, the shedding of my blood, is for the remission and the forgiveness of your sin, past, present, and future. So drink it to the bottom. What I'm about to do for you, have my body broken for you and my blood shed for you, is the fulfillment of this entire meal, he's saying. You've been feasting on this meal since you were a newborn, and I'm telling you, this feast has always been pointing to me. I am the completion of Passover. And remember how we said the meal itself captures the themes, like the bitterness into joy and the leaving with haste. And some Orthodox Jewish families will leave the door open in the room where they're feasting as a way to, oh, we gotta go. We gotta be ready to go when it's time to go because we have promises that we're stepping into. All of those themes, death and judgment visiting our ancestors but being protected by it, by the blood of another. All of those things, Jesus is saying, those realities are actually what the new kingdom is all about. It's what the new covenant is all about. Because just take one of these for example. Like, your ancestors were enslaved to Pharaoh. You weren't enslaved to Pharaoh, but what Jesus is saying is you're enslaved to a much greater oppressor known as sin. And sin has you in bonds and sin has you in chains. And I'm telling you, I'm coming to set you free from that. Even if you still struggle with sin, you're free from its punishment. You're free from its bondage. Even if you can't kick old habits, that sin doesn't have a hold on you anymore. Or the angel of death and judgment. He would say, hey, that angel of death and judgment that visited Egypt thousands of years ago, that represented God's just wrath, that angel of death visited families and only visited one member of that family. What about the death and judgment and the just wrath of God for all of creation? You're going to want to find a place to hide when he visits. And I'm telling you, I'm here to protect you from that visit of death and judgment. Hide behind me, hide behind my blood, and death will pass over you. All these themes, this is all culminating in Jesus. He's saying his death is the central and climactic moment in the history of the world. All of the Jewish traditions, all the Old Testament pages, they were all pointing to something. And I'm going to take, Jesus is saying, I'm going to take the seminal feast that is the defining event in your history. And I'm going to tell you it was all about me. Everything has always been about me. Everything has always been pointing to me. Everything has been moving towards this. This is the exodus to end all exoduses. And this is how you know Jesus is bringing it all together. This is how you know Jesus is showing something to the disciples and to the reader that's almost too deep for words. He's revealing something without even saying it. And he wants to get it into the heart, and he wants to leave the disciples not just confused, but he wants to leave the disciples awestruck with what they just experienced. So this is kind of what's unsaid in the passage is saying a lot, and the disciples would have experienced it this way too. So every Jew knows, even modern day Jews knows, that at Passover, a Seder meal, they call it, there are all kinds of elements. We talked about them, bitter herbs and horseradish and wine and bread. And there's all these elements that are part of the meal. But every Jew knows that the main course of Passover, the main thing, is lamb. The lamb that was slaughtered on Passover night for the blood to be shed on the doorframe, they were then to take that lamb, that dead slain lamb, in and cook it and eat it. Probably rare because they didn't have time. Like we gotta get out. We gotta get on the road. So we're cooking the lamb that we just slaughtered, and that became the central eating thing at Passover meals. It's the main course, and for millennia. At every Passover, in every home, in every country, in every year, they have had a lamb as their main course. Every gospel writer that tells you about this night of Passover, the Last Supper, they mention every other element of the meal. And yet none of them mention that a lamb was eaten. It's the main part. It's the whole part. All of the elements of the meal are here except one. And any Jew reading this, the Jews that experienced it that night with Jesus would have been wondering, where's the lamb? It would be almost as if you read or heard about a Thanksgiving feast and there was no mention of turkey. Like, wait, I mean, no one really likes the white meat, but like we have to eat it, I guess, but you didn't even mention a turkey? You didn't even give a reason why there wasn't one there? Like what, then I'm not sure, wait, what was going on? There's bread, there's wine, there's herbs, there's drink, there's blessing. There's no lamb. Jesus is letting them experience what the New Testament will go on to tell us explicitly. Jesus is the final Passover lamb. And in the same way that the blood of the lamb protected the ancestors in Egypt on that night, the same way that it was their covering to deliver them from death, Jesus is saying, I am your once and for all Passover lamb here. And here's what I want to do right now. I would love to go, let me tell you about all that a substitutionary atonement, Jesus, let me tell you what that means for you. Let me apply that. Let me explain that. And there is a place to do that. Except Jesus didn't do it this night. He just let the meal speak for itself. He let them experience it with all of its awe and wonder. And here's what the meal just said with the bread breaking and the wine pouring and the no lamb. He just told them and you this. The spotless king of the kingdom is about to become your slaughtered lamb. He will be your deliverer. He will be your protection. He will be your provider. That's what Jesus did with the disciples. And as would be fitting for any Passover meal, Jesus ends the meal with a future promise. Remember, they were to leave with haste. They were to look ahead to the land that God was taking them to. There was always this remembering and looking ahead in the Passover meal. Look at what he tells them as he closes out the meal before he takes them to the Garden of Gethsemane with him. Verse 29. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Okay, with the bread breaking and the blood pouring and the shedding and the no lamb here, he has been telling them, I'm about to die. And all the meaning of it is wrapped up in this redemption story of your people. But even if they aren't tracking, in addition to telling them that he was going to die and what his death would mean, he also just closed out by giving them resurrection hope. My body's going to be ripped apart. I'm going to be pouring out my blood for you, but I'm going to see you again. We will drink wine together again in the new creation. Not grape juice, Church of Christ folks, not grape juice, wine. Really good wine when kingdom comes. We will drink wine again together. When you see me die, you're going to scatter and there's going to be bitterness, there's going to be fear, but I'm coming back. See, because Passover was always very much about looking ahead. Remember that the original experiencers of Passover, you've been forced to live in a land that is not your own, and Passover is telling you this is not your home, a different land is. They were forced to be slaves for 400 years. They didn't own their own land. They didn't have an identity. They didn't have a place. This land that you have been made to dwell in is not your home. Let me take you home. The Passover was the first night of a new order. You don't belong here, Israelites. You belong in a better land. That's what Jesus is saying here with that last promise. You belong in a promised land with me. You belong there with me. And I will drink wine with you in the new kingdom when all is made right. When we get there, I will drink with you again there one day. And so every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, communion, no lamb anymore, final sacrifice. Christian, every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, know that I will drink it with you one day in the new kingdom. Know that when you taste bitterness here and loss here, one day all that will turn into joy as we toast each other in the new kingdom. Know that the Passover itself was a means to an end. And I'm telling you, my body and my blood has just bought you that end. Heard yesterday from a pastor friend of mine up in Baltimore about an old Jonathan Edwards sermon. He's a great awakening preacher, greatest mind of the history of the United States, potentially. He preached a sermon hundreds of years ago called Approaching the End of God's Grand Design. Which, let me know, I need to title my sermons better. Approaching the End of God's Grand Design. Here's what he does. He compares the great end of all things, the day of the Lord, the consummation of the kingdom. He compares them to a great river. And he says, this great river of life that's flowing in the new heavens and the new earth, this great river has innumerable streams leading up and into it. And they get lost in this great river. And those innumerable streams are your story, like you, your life. And all the things that happen to us in those streams, they find their end in the great river, in the end of God's grand design. Eventually, all things come together and eventually all things will be made right. And see, when we're in our little streams, like the innumerable streams of our life and the chaos, when loss is great, when fear is great, when sin is great, when pain has left like a hole in your chest and there's shame and there's rage and there's confusion, there's doubt. Here's where we go with that in our stream. We believe very easily that in our stream, we fear there's no way this stream could lead us to the great river. There's no way my stream will end in the great river. And Edwards goes on to say this. Oftentimes, the appearance of things is so dark that it looks as though those great things would never come to pass in the end. But yet there is a time coming wherein this great design will be completed. The time is coming when it will be seen, actually finished, and God's great ends will be obtained. Everything shall come out right at last. Or in the words of Jesus at the Last Supper, one day you will sip the finest wine with him in his Father's kingdom. And until that day, we feast on the body and blood of the Lamb. Let's pray. Jesus, our Passover Lamb, so much could be said about what you did in that upper room on that night. But Jesus, would you help us just to behold it? That you completed this story that is our story. That made it so, yes, we could be set free. That made it so, yes, you've delivered us from our bondage. That you've turned bitter things into joyful things. But most of all, Jesus, you bought for us an inheritance and a kingdom and a promised land. You say, this is what's coming. I will drink with you again in the new kingdom. So we wait that day. We long for that day. Until that day, would you feed us with your body and blood? We pray in your name. Amen.